Welcome back, everybody, for another deep dive. This time, we're taking a look at a case I'm sure you've at least heard of. Keyes v. School District knows one.
Oh, yeah. A big one, for sure.
Whether you're a lawyer, a law student, or just someone who likes to follow these big legal cases, this is one you got to know about.
Definitely.
You know, we all remember Brown v. Board of Education and the fight against segregated schools in the South, but Keyes is tackling something a little more subtle.
Yeah, it gets at a really tricky question.
Right. What happens when there aren't laws actually saying schools should be segregated, but they still end up that way?
Exactly. Like, can the courts even step in and do anything about that? It's a question that goes way beyond just Denver in 1973.
All right, so paint us a picture. What's going on in Denver at this time?
Okay, so we're in Denver, Colorado in 1973. No more Jim Crow, no whites-only signs or anything like that. On the surface, things seem pretty integrated.
But I'm guessing that wasn't the whole story?
Nope.
Not at all. You zoom in on a neighborhood like Park Hill, and you see a very different picture. Schools are still super segregated along racial lines.
And this is where our case begins, right? With the folks in Park Hill saying, hold on a minute, something's not right here.
Exactly. And they weren't just focused on Park Hill. They were saying this was a pattern across the whole Denver school system, that the school board was deliberately keeping schools segregated.
Okay, so even without those explicit segregation laws, they were arguing that the school board was still pulling strings behind the scenes to keep things separated.
Right, and this is where things get interesting. Brown v. Board was about what we call de jure segregation. That's segregation by law.
Okay.
Keyes is going after de facto segregation in fact or in practice.
So how do you even begin to prove that? I mean, proving deliberate action when things could just be the result of, you know, people living in certain areas or whatever.
Yeah, that was the challenge. The plaintiffs had to show that the school board wasn't just letting segregation happen. They wanted it that way.
I see. So they had to demonstrate intent. Exactly. Intent was key.
All right, so how did they do that? What kind of evidence did they use?
Well, they pointed to a bunch of things the board was doing that sure looked a lot like intentional segregation, like gerrymandering, you know, messing with school zones to keep black students clustered in certain schools.
Oh, so like drawing the lines in a way that benefited.
Yeah, exactly. Then there was the way they were building new schools, placing them in mostly white neighborhoods, which furthered the segregation.
Interesting.
And get this, they even brought up the fact that the school board had these integration policies in place at one point, and then boom, just got rid of them.
Oh, wow. So it's like they were trying to integrate and then suddenly change their minds.
Yeah. It all looked pretty suspicious, like they were trying to maintain segregation without saying it outright.
So what happened? Did the courts buy it?
Well, the district court did agree that there was intentional segregation in Park Hill and ordered those schools desegregated.
It's a win.
Right.
It was, but only a partial one. They didn't extend the order to the whole city. They said, you need more proof of intent for the rest of Denver.
Oh, so even though the plaintiffs felt like this was happening citywide, they had to prove it for each individual.
Yeah, and that's where things get tricky. How do you prove the school board's intent for every single decision they made across the whole city? It seems almost impossible.
Right.
And that's where the Supreme Court comes in. The case ends up in the hands of Justice Brennan, and he, along with the majority opinion, does something really interesting. They essentially say, look, school systems aren't a bunch of separate pieces decisions made in one area like in Park Hill. They have ripple effects across the whole district.
Hmm. So they're acknowledging that a school board can't just say, oh, we didn't mean to segregate over there, when their actions in one part of the city are showing a pattern.
Exactly. The court was saying you can't just pretend these things are happening in isolation. And this is huge because it shifts the burden of proof.
So instead of the plaintiffs having to prove intent everywhere all the time,
Now the school board has to prove they weren't intentionally segregating in other areas.
Whoa, that's a major change.
It was a game changer for sure. And as you can imagine, it sparked a ton of debate.
Oh, I bet I can already hear those dissenting opinions brewing.
Yeah.
But before we get into all of that, let's take a second for everyone listening to really grasp this shift in who has to prove what. It's a huge deal.
Totally. It really exposed how intentional segregation could exist, even when you didn't have those explicitly racist laws on the books.
All right, we'll lead the way. Let's hear what those dissenting voices had to say about all of this.
Okay, so as you can imagine, a decision this big, this impactful, it didn't go unchallenged.
Right. There had to be some pushback.
Oh, yeah. The dissenting opinions in Keyes are just as important, I think, to understanding, you know, the whole picture.
Absolutely.
Like Justice Rehnquist, he argued pretty strongly that this whole idea of making the school board prove they weren't segregating it was basically flipping the script on our legal system.
You mean like the whole innocent until proven guilty thing?
Exactly. He felt like the court was saying guilty until proven innocent, which is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, that's a fundamental part of our justice system, right? Rehnquist must felt like the court was way overstepping its bounds.
That was his argument for sure. He was worried about this idea of presumed intent, like it was giving judges too much power, forcing districts to desegregate, even if they didn't explicitly mean to.
So it's that classic tension, right?
Uh-huh.
Ensuring equal opportunities for all students, but also respecting local control over education.
Yeah, it's a tough balance, and you can see how this would lead to some strong disagreements, even within the court itself.
No kidding. So was Rehnquist the only one with concerns?
Oh, no. Justice Powell had some thoughts, too.
Okay. What did he have to say?
Well, he actually agreed with getting rid of that strict separation between de jure and de facto segregation.
Interesting.
But he had major reservations about using busing as the main way to desegregate.
Yes, busing always a hot button issue.
It sure was, and still is to some extent.
So what were his issues with it?
Well, for Powell, it wasn't just about, you know, people not wanting their kids on buses. He was worried about forcing kids to travel really far to go to school outside their neighborhoods.
Right.
He thought it put a huge burden on families, could disrupt communities, even potentially hurt the quality of education.
That's a good point. It's like busing was meant to fix things, but it wasn't a perfect solution.
Exactly. It had its own set of problems. And I think it highlights how complex this whole issue of achieving truly integrated schools really is.
Absolutely. It's not just about changing laws. It's about changing hearts and minds. And that's a lot harder.
No doubt about it.
So let's talk about the legacy of Keyes. You mentioned the Keyes test earlier. Can you break that down for us? Like, how did this decision actually change things in the legal world?
All right, so the Keyes test, it's basically a three-part test to figure out if a school district is guilty of de jure segregation, even when there aren't any explicit segregation laws on the books.
Okay, three parts. Let's hear them.
So first, the plaintiffs, they have to show that a big chunk of the school system is intentionally segregated. This could be through things like gerrymandering or discriminatory school siting, those kinds of things.
Got it. So step one is proving there's a clear pattern of actions meant to segregate.
Right. And then once they've shown that pattern in one part of the district, a presumption arises that other segregated schools in the system are also the result of intentional segregation. And here's the key. The burden of proof shifts to the school board.
Okay, so now it's on the school board to defend themselves, not on the plaintiffs, to keep proving intent everywhere.
You got it. That's the heart of the Keyes test.
All right, and what's the third part?
So the third part is where the school board gets a chance to fight back. They have to prove that the segregation in other areas isn't because of anything they did. It's because of other stuff like housing patterns or demographics, you know, things they can't control.
So they have to convince the court it was all just a coincidence, basically.
Basically, yeah. And that can be pretty tough to do.
I bet. It sounds like the Keyes test really gave those fighting against segregation a much needed tool, especially in places where proving intent was really difficult.
It forced school districts to take a hard look at their policies and practices.
But I'm guessing it also stirred up a lot of controversy, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Some people saw this as the federal government overstepping its boundaries, forcing integration on communities that didn't want it.
It's interesting how these legal battles often reflect bigger social and political tensions.
Mm.
It's not just about the law. It's about deeply held beliefs and anxieties about change.
Right. Keyes really forced America to have some uncomfortable conversations about race equality and the legacy of segregation.
And it's a conversation we're still having today in a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
So how did things play out after Keyes? Did the Keyes test actually lead to widespread desegregation? Or were there roadblocks?
Well, it's a complicated story. Yeah, it's a complicated story for sure. Keyes definitely made some big waves, but it wasn't a cure-all, you know?
Right. It's never that simple.
It faced a lot of pushback and some real practical challenges. And then over time, the legal landscape kind of shifted too.
So it wasn't just about winning the case. It was about what happened next.
Exactly. So for one thing, putting those desegregation plans into action, especially when it came to busing, it turned out to be super difficult and divisive.
Yeah, I can imagine.
A lot of white parents didn't want to send their kids to predominantly black schools. And black parents were worried about, you know, their kids facing discrimination in mostly white schools.
Right. It makes sense, but it's still sad. you know.
It is. It's a reminder that laws can change, but people's attitudes and fears, those take a lot longer.
So it was about more than just changing the rules on paper.
Absolutely. And on top of that, the Supreme Court itself started to change over time. And there was this growing hesitation to support really broad desegregation remedies.
Mm. So the legal tide was turning.
Yeah, it was. And the momentum from Keyes started to slow down.
Are there any specific cases that illustrate this shift?
Oh, yeah. Milliken v. Bradley, just a few years after Keyes, is a big one.
What happened there?
So in Milliken, the Supreme Court said that desegregation remedies couldn't go beyond the boundaries of one school district, even if the segregation was happening because of things going on across multiple districts.
Oh, wow. So even if the problem was bigger than one district, the solution had to stay within those lines.
Exactly. And this kind of set the stage for a lot of decisions that followed. The court became more and more focused on local control of schools and less willing to let federal courts impose these big sweeping desegregation plans.
Hmm. So that brings us to today, with school segregation sadly making a comeback in a lot of ways.
It is sad to see.
Yeah, driven by things like, you know, housing patterns, school choice programs, economic inequality.
Yeah.
So where does that leave Keyes? Does it even matter anymore?
Well, it might not have the same legal power it did back then, but I think it's still a really important reminder about the fight for equal education.
Okay, how so?
It shows us that policies that seem neutral, you know, on the surface can still have a discriminatory impact, and that schools have a duty to actively address segregation regardless of intent.
So even though the legal landscape has shifted, those core principles of Keyes still matter.
Absolutely. It's not just a history lesson. It's a framework for understanding how complex and tricky this whole issue of school segregation really is.
Right. And a reminder that the fight's not over.
Not at all. Keyes pushed us to really think about how segregation shows up, how to prove it, and how to fight it. And that's still just as important today.
So it's not enough to just get rid of those obvious forms of discrimination. We have to be paying attention all the time, looking for those hidden ways that inequality persists.
Right. And that means understanding de facto segregation, all those subtle ways that bias can sneak into decision making, and the long-term damage that happens when we don't do anything about it.
It's a call to action for everyone listening, lawyers, law students, anyone who cares about creating a fairer world.
Couldn't have said it better myself, Keyes v. School District. No.
Yeah.
It reminds us that achieving educational justice, it's a marathon, not a sprint. It takes dedication, critical thinking, and the courage to challenge the way things are.
Well said. So there you have it, folks, a deep dive into Keyes v. School District Number 1. Hopefully you've learned something new about how school segregation works, how it's been fought, and why it's still such a critical issue today.
Thanks for joining us.
And until next time, keep learning, keep questioning, and keep fighting for a more just and equitable world for everyone.